forever. Dog.
Hey folks, happy new year. Hope your holidays were pleasant and restful. We're back to our regular weekly schedule next week. But for now, I wanted to bring you this very special episode. This is another one that I recorded back when I was in New York in October. And as such, the audio is not great. But again, it's a terrific conversation, this time with author Paul Tremblay. And I didn't want to lose it. It's worth a listen. Don't listen on headphones. I'll tell you that much. We had to meet in public. And, there's a bar right behind us so that you can hear at one point the bartender shaking cocktails. It's very annoying. Trust me, it was more annoying being there. But it was a terrific conversation with Paul Tremblay, who is one of the best authors we have around right now, working in any genre. If you only read one book by Paul, check out A Head Full of Ghosts. It's the best exorcism story since The Exorcist. That is not an overstatement. His other novels, Disappearance at Devil's Creek, The Cabin at the End of the World, his short story collection, Growing Things, and other stories, all are terrific, all worth your time. Paul writes primarily in the horror genre. He's a deeply empathetic writer. He's a great storyteller. I'm just blown away by his work, and I really relish this opportunity to talk to Paul about writing, about horror, about math. He teaches math at a private school outside Boston. He has a new book called Survivor Song, possibly called Survivor Song, that is out this summer, which you should definitely pre-order. In the meantime, please enjoy this conversation with Paul Tremblay. As I say, as of a couple weeks from now, we'll be back to our regular schedule. We're going for a weekly schedule from now through summer anyway. And so that means I need to book more podcasts. Let me know who you want to hear from. What are you watching on television? What's getting you excited? And so what showrunners and creators do you want to hear some tales and advice from? I'll do my best to book some of those folks. Hit me up on Twitter at Ben Blacker, or like the page on Facebook, facebook.com/thewriterspanel. I love hearing from you all. Please enjoy this episode.
They write, they talk, and talk about what they write. Tune in tonight, or whenever the time is right. It's the Writer's Panel with Ben Blacker, and it's starting now. Oh, yeah!
As you know, getting that first draft down,
yeah,
I'm sure is the hardest. Or maybe that is not for you. Maybe that's the fun part for you.
Yeah. So I typically, I wish I was someone who could just be like, blah, and get out like the draft. I move like really slowly, like in increments. So I tend to always edit what I do or what I've written the day before I move on. So by the time I have a complete draft, it's been, you know, it's not to say it's perfect.
Right.
It's not. But it's definitely not like, I mean, the structure's there. It's pretty much, you know, not copy editing, but it's, you know, tying things up and making sure. So
that's funny. You know, you often hear the opposite.
Right.
Like, go through, do that vomit draft or whatever you call it.
Yeah.
Just get the ideas down, because going back will make you second guess, will make you
right.
Rethink the things. Is it that you're better adjusted than most people?
I don't know. It's funny. I think it's like people ask me all the time, have you written like a math horror story? Because I teach math.
Funny.
It's like, no, I've never written a math story, but maybe I think the way I approach my writing might be somewhat analytical
mm-hmm.
in that way. But no, I've met people who sort of use a process similar to mine.
Oh, sure.
But I am jealous of the people who can just spit it out, because my favorite part is actually once it's a complete thing and editing it, moving little things around.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe it's my favorite part because I know most of the pieces have sort of been hard won and in place already.
Yeah, it's funny.
You know, if that makes sense.
Do you find, though, that, like, what does that do for the discovery process for you in writing? Does that still exist? Like,
sure.
How does that work?
No, it's definitely still there. So, I mean, every novel's been different. I would say for most of them, I've written an outline first.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, a lot of the discovery comes before the story, at least in terms of the plot. Because for me as a writer, plot's the hardest part. Like, I feel very comfortable with character and voice. And that's where actually a lot of my discovery happens, because I sort of let the characters sort of, you know, do and say what they end up saying, which, you know, I don't anticipate always.
Yeah. And let me, I'm going to interrupt you a bunch because I want to sort of dig in on stuff. Like, is that a document that's just for you? Does that go to the editors? You know, you were under a deal, so you sort of, I imagine that made things easier. As far as
I typically don't send them anything. The only time I was forced to was I had a 2-book deal with A Headful of Ghosts and Disappearance at Devil's Rock. So to get back on deal, you know, they very much wanted to do another deal with me. My editor said, we need 50 pages of a summary. And that was for Cabin at the End of the World. So yeah, she did see an early outline, which changed after. I sent that to her. It was sort of a half-assed outline to, like, I think the outline really, like, the first 2/3 of the book. And, like, the end, I just sort of, like, hand-waved.
Sure. And I think that's fair.
So every outline's a little bit different. Like, the book I just turned in, I really wrote, it's barely an outline, it was like 3 pages. So I essentially outlined like the first 100 pages, and then I said, hey, here are the, like the big things that will happen later.
Yeah.
But that was it. So, and that can be, for me, that's hard. It's harder to write that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, it can kind of, I like having the roadmap, but also can be kind of fun, like to make it up as you go. A Head Full of Ghosts, I had no outline at all.
Is that right?
I feel like I got just lucky, like the idea sort of just fell in my lap. I did keep notes, like I kept a notebook.
Mm-hmm.
I knew like fairly early on, I knew, okay, it was going to have, you know, the pre-exorcism, you know, TV show exorcism and post-exorcism structure.
Mm-hmm.
I knew there were going to be, you know, some blog posts. So
but,
I would like...
But even like, it's such an unusual format, right? Like, the structurally, it's a pretty straightforward story. But the way it's presented is anything but. So, like... Using that as an example,
sure.
Going in, you know, like you say, you know the structure, but how does the format present itself?
Yeah,
so and at what point are you like, I guess that's a book?
For that book, I did, you know, I have a little notebook and I still have it. It was funny to sort of read through. But I did do, like, before I sat down to write the book, I did sketch out some ideas. And I eventually came up, okay, it's 2 sisters. Oh, there's going to be a blogger. You know, yeah, and how it's all intertwined. So it wasn't quite an outline, but like I had some like big ideas like that I kept in a little notebook.
Yeah.
But I certainly didn't do what I've done for other books, which is like a 10-page essentially a description of the plot, or you know what's going to happen next kind of thing. I don't know. For me, I really try to treat each book as like totally different. I don't want to fall into like this is what I did for the last book, so that's what I do for this book. I try to almost curate. Even like the pre-writing process to be, even if it's just fooling myself into thinking it's totally different, into making it this new thing. You know, as a reminder, like every book is different.
So what is that pre-writing? I mean, it sounds like, you know, you work the way a lot of us do, which is sort of the threads start to come together. And I'm sure it's a lot of staring off into space or taking walks or whatever, like the non-work work that goes on in the back of your brain. How do you make that process different for each book? Like, what does that look like for you?
It's funny. It's almost like at the beginning, I decide, like with A Cam at the End of the World, I sort of wrote the summary against my will. Like I decided this book's in my head, you know, when I had the idea, feels like a little bit like A Head Full of Ghosts felt to me, like when I had the idea. You know, I wanted A Cam to feel like a really immediate, like in the moment. So in my head, it's like, okay, I'm not going to write a summary, but then I had to get on.
Right.
So like, that's why I was joking. I sort of wrote a half-assed summary. It was more just for someone else, not necessarily for me.
And it feels like, I don't know, creatively, emotionally, if you had to put more of yourself into that summary, would it have spent it for you?
I think there is a danger in that. So when I was off deal, I had actually wrote like, I had this other novel idea before Cabin at the End of the World.
Okay.
And I ended up writing, it took like a month, and I wrote like a 30-page summary, which is absurd. You know, 6,000 words.
Yeah.
So when I got done writing with that summary, I was kind of like, ugh, I feel like I just wrote the story. You know, I kind of dreaded the thought of, because this was going to be like, it would have been like a really big book, too, length-wise, I think. So my my editor rejected it, which actually was somewhat of a relief.
I'm going to give it back up.
Sure. It was somewhat of a relief because I was like, oh, okay. My agent was devastated, but my editor and I have like a great relationship. And she's sort of like no BS. And after Headful of Ghosts, we'd gone back and forth with book ideas before it became Devil's Rocks. I was like, okay, I'll just try to come up with something else. Like, her rejection of that 30-page thing was, vampires. I'm like, well, they're not really vampires. It's like a lot of stuff. And she was like, I'm like, okay.
That's really funny. I mean, let's pause there for a sec, because this is all part of the process and part of making a living as a writer of any kind is rejection.
Sure.
And even for someone who's, you know, published so many stories, a couple of books, a few novels at that time.
Yeah.
Like, what do you do with that, and how do you move on to the next thing?
So I even feel like the editing process is a form of rejection. You know, just like when you're... And just because they're saying, hey, you know, this thing that you spent like a year, year and a half with, you need to change this.
Yeah. You're not perfect.
You know, typically it's like, hey, this has been in my head this way for a year and a half.
Yeah.
So, and I feel like I've learned the hard way. when I was a younger writer, I would make mistakes with this rule, but I've come up with a rule, what I call the 24-hour rule.
Mm-hmm.
And I think all writers should go by this.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you're, I guess, maybe more well-adjusted than I am.
No,
but if I get a rejection or a critique, edits, mm-hmm. comments, my rule is I cannot, or I should not, respond to it in any way until 24 hours have passed.
Yeah.
I give myself permission to be a petulant baby.
Absolutely.
You know, like
within the confines of your home.
Yeah, within the confines of my head, or just walk around like raving to myself for 24 hours. And almost, I feel like I've trained myself now to be able to do this, but almost unerringly, 24 hours later, I can be way more objective.
Mm-hmm.
I can see sort of where those comments or the rejection came from. And then I'm more able to say, you know, either I agree with it or I don't, but I think I'm in a more rational, objective space to be able to say why, like, or find a compromise. That's typically what happens, certainly in the edit part of things. There's not much compromise for the rejection part of it.
No.
Other than, I guess, it's just acceptance.
Right. It's a kind of personal compromise.
Yeah.
Did you, especially as like a newer writer, did you get from your editor, from you know, early readers, did you hear the same feedback a lot?
So it's funny. So early on, I feel like my process was, I had the luxury to be patient because I was a high school teacher.
Yeah.
You know, so I already had shitty health insurance in place. So I always try to take like the long view of things, even though it's really hard to do. And I know it's almost impossible to do now. I'm very happy I'm not like coming up as a new writer now, because I think it's almost impossible to feel like you can be patient just with all the bombardment of, you know, social media, other writers talking about their great news. I mean, it messes with my head. I can't imagine what it does to new writers. So, like, the first short stories I wrote, you know, I would send out, and I felt like I saw a progression where I would get the form letters, but then I would start getting some comments like, hey, we like this, and this is why, and, you know, and they were encouraging, and I could see sort of, I felt like I could see my improvement through those rejection letters, and then finally, you know, I started getting some acceptances.
Yeah. But yeah, you do tend to feel that tipping point when it's a different kind of rejection.
Right.
It's, you show potential.
Right.
Basically.
Yeah.
And
for a while, it was very much just me. I mean, aside from my cousin Michael and his husband Rob and my aunt Mary and her wife Debbie were my first, like, consistent first readers.
Hmm.
And my wife, too. She was an English major.
Yeah.
This is, like, way early. Just first started messing around with writing. You know, so they would give me feedback, but, you know, they weren't... You know, with the exception of my wife, who was great with, like, fixing plot holes. She was trained in English.
Right.
You know, for those readers, it's more like, you know, their field, the story, and stuff like that. But, you know, I didn't get an MFA, so really I learned a lot from just reading my ass off.
Sure.
But also just getting rejections and then listening to what people are saying.
Right. And it feels like the second part of that is something a lot of new writers need to learn.
So I'm really talking, like, for me, these were like the years, like 1999 through like 2003, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
2004.
But, you know, it's interesting too. I mean, you're an established adult by that time, right?
Yeah.
You have a job,
you have
a family. Why start writing?
that's a hard one to answer. You know, I'm just sitting here thinking about it because it is hard to answer. When I grew up in high school, you know, I didn't have a lot of friends, and I really sort of like just kept to myself, and my world then wasn't a reader. I would come home and watch cable TV,
mm-hmm.
or come home and listen to records with the laying on the ground with this big fat old, you know, record player stereo speakers tented over my head. But in, you know, in retrospect, I had a very lively sort of daydream fantasy imagination, mm-hmm. especially when I was listening to records. I was either imagining what videos would fit with those, or typically I was imagining myself performing on stage along with the records. I have to admit, I still do that as an adult when I listen to music, which
amazing.
Is, I don't know if that's weird or not, but...
It only works in your car.
Yeah.
Like, that's the best time for that.
Yeah, and I, you know, I was in school, like math was my best subject, so I just kind of stuck with it as a default. So anyway, you know, I finally fell in love with reading in my early 20s.
What was the gateway for you? What got you reading?
I sort of fumbled into a mathematics humanities double major in college by mistake, because I was supposed to be math education, but I panicked because I was doing really poorly in a math class and changed it to math humanities. So now I couldn't be a teacher. But anyway, the very last class I took, second semester senior year, was at English 101, Lit 101.
Where was it?
And this was at Providence College.
Okay, great.
Because most of my other humanities was like philosophy, history.
Right.
So in that class, you know, it was almost like the stereotypical, just a cool professor. Mm-hmm. I really connected with him because he liked the music that I liked. You know, I was a big punk Husker Du fan. He loved the Dead Boys. So in all my papers I wrote, I made some connection to music. And he, you know, he fed that in me.
Sorry.
And in that class, we read Joyce Carol Oates' Where Are You Going, Where Are You Been? Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget reading it and thinking, I didn't know people wrote things like this.
Yeah.
You know, because my experience in high school was reading, you know,
the classics
or, you know, the canon, quote unquote canon.
Absolutely.
So shortly after that, my birthday that summer after graduation, Lisa bought me The Stand. And I just inhaled it. So when I went away to University of Vermont for 2 years, I spent those 2 years really struggling to get my math degree and doing the long distance relationship thing.
Oh my
but
gosh.
I just fell in love with reading. I read all the King and from King and went to, you know, read more Oates. And then, like, Troy Jackson, Peter Straub, and Clive Barker. So at the end of 2 years, you know, I'd inhaled all these books, and I had this weird itch to try to write.
Huh.
At the same time, I had taught myself how to play guitar.
Mm-hmm.
So honestly, if I had my druthers, if I could go back in time and make
sure.
myself, like, a successful musician instead of a successful writer, I think there's a part of me that
Which is harder,
would still
do
that. Yeah.
Like, they both seem impossible.
No, they're so super hard, yeah.
Right?
So I found out eventually that I was a better writer than musician. So
sure.
That was a long answer to say. There was clearly, like, some want or need for, like, a creative outlet that was in there, and
yeah,
I just sort of answered it, you know?
Absolutely. It's funny. I mean, were you a horror kid?
Yes.
Like, how did she know to get you The Stand?
Well, she was a big Stephen King reader, and you know, as a child, there was a program in Massachusetts called Creature Double Feature.
Absolutely, WLVI.
Yeah, WLVI, Channel 56. Yeah. So for me, that was I watched that every weekend. But the I love the Godzilla movies. That was more my thing. And I would watch the second movie, but those tended to scare the shit out of me, and I would have terrible nightmares. Even something stupid like Attack of the Killer Shrews. I vividly remember a nightmare based on the Attack of the Killer Shrews.
Oh my god! I was trying to remember what they. I remember they played a lot of the Godzilla stuff, but what did they pair it with? The only thing I remembered was watching Creature from the Black Lagoon in 3D with my dad.
Oh yeah, I think I remember that being like that was like prime
it was a big
time
deal.
Like,
you had to go get the glasses from like the CBS or something.
The ones. A lot of black and white movies, they would pair it like The Amazing Colossal Man, Quatermass in the Pit, this old Hammer British film, which in the U.S. was called 5 Million Years to Earth, which I've recently rediscovered as an adult. I love that movie
so
much.
I haven't watched it
probably
in 30 years.
Shout Factory just put out a beautiful Blu-ray. No,
nice.
Scream Factory, sorry.
Okay.
A beautiful Blu-ray restoration.
Awesome. I'll totally check it out.
The Brain That Wouldn't Die. That movie was really kind of, that was, you know, exploitative, and that got to me, like the violence in that. So I had this weird, like, attraction to it, but I was also terrified of it. Like, a big time scaredy cat would sleep with stuffed animals around my head.
Oh my god.
The funny part is, my brother, who was 5 years younger than me, was full horror, like, at age 10, watching, like, Texas Chainsaw Massacre. You know, and I didn't watch that until I was 5 years ago.
No, that's a lot to take.
Yeah, so he that's it was really funny. Like, I remember, like, when Poltergeist would come on, it was on HBO all the time.
Yeah,
like, I would ceremoniously lead him out of the TV room. Come on, Dan, you can't watch this. And it was really because I didn't want to watch the face tearing scene.
Yeah,
you know, I could watch the rest of it, but like the gore violence stuff as a kid, especially, really got to me.
That's really it's a little surprising to hear, having read Cabin at the End of the World, which is so brutal.
Yeah, no,
like,
it is.
Where does that come from in you?
It's funny. I feel like for me, it's a little easier to do in writing as opposed to seeing it in a movie. Like,
sure.
I don't know that part of it.
Was it easier to take in as a reader too? Because like some of that King stuff gets.
Yeah, well, I
heavy.
Think like as a reader, you can self edit or you can self skim. You can just read the words as opposed to like fully engaging into the visuals of what's going on.
Absolutely.
Now, I was definitely aware of the violence in Cabin, and I wanted to treat, you know, I try to treat violence in general in my stories, like with, this might sound weird, but like with a dignity.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So what I mean by that is that it respects the experience of the person experiencing the violence, obviously, whether or not, you know, she may live or die. But the people who witness it especially, but also even the people perpetrating the violence, because everybody has changed. Like, if you've ever had the unfortunate, the misfortune to witness like a really violent act, that changes everybody in the room or in the area.
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like most of my horror stuff, especially in the long form, I try to root everything in realism. So I really wanted to, you know, the violence was going to be brutal. It had to be like a fundamentally changing act for everybody involved. Hopefully that's what happened.
I think what you do so well in all of your writing is the characters are characters. I mean, there's real humanity to characters, which, like, I mean, it's what first attracted me to Head Full of Ghosts, and it's what in Cabin at the End of the World makes so much of the violence so brutal. Right, as you grow to love these characters and you come to understand the perpetrators of the violence, have you ever had? It's a weird question because it's something we get sort of in TV and film where you get a little pushback on having empathy for the villains.
Yeah,
is this a conversation that you have to have with editors or with yourself even as you're sort of putting these together?
You should know myself. My editor's been great. She's never really pushed back on anything aside that she thinks doesn't work. And it's never been, oh, this is too violent or this is too icky. It's more just been like story level stuff.
That's great.
Yeah. You know, I guess, you know, for Cabin in particular, I did want to make at least three of the four invaders experience. That's part of the horror, the idea that you're not responsible or you're not in control for your actions. So, you know, I think clearly, you know, there's an attraction to that, like a dangerous attraction to the idea that you get to absolve responsibility for what you say or do because of your belief in something else, right? That's why people join cults. You know, I'm not going to castigate all religions, but I mean, you know, there's a line there somewhere. Like, where's that line where it changes from, I don't know, where it changes from like faith to something that's breaking with the social compact, you know, of all of us kind of thing.
It's a fascinating conversation.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, I think there's, if for people to read the book, there's one invader I'm clearly not empathizing with. Right. He's sort of like a political stand-in.
You understand his perspective.
Sure. Like, even him, yeah. It's not like he's just like a cackling, mustache-twisting villain. Like,
right. Which would be easy to do.
Right.
What is it that you think, you know, like, these books have been successful, both creatively and, you know, with the public. What is it that you think people respond to?
Jeez, I don't know. Honestly,
or is that too terrifying to think
about? Yeah, I mean, my hope is, it's funny, a different writer posted on Twitter, which I really fundamentally disagreed with, and I thought was terrible advice. Surprise, bad advice, writing advice on Twitter. You know, but he said, oh, no, like, if you're not writing with the audience in mind, you'll never sell anything, essentially, is what he said. I don't know. I think that's crap, to say it lightly. Because I don't write with an audience in mind. I guess that maybe that's not 100% true, but I try not to write with an audience in mind. Like, my hope is that if I like this, that there are enough people that share similar interests that they would like it too. I mean, because I feel like it's hard enough to do that. Never mind putting the pressure on myself to think of, like, this nebulous audience.
Absolutely.
That you have to satisfy.
So you were saying that, like, you don't have a grasp yet on what the next thing is.
I did just turn in a book, so I know what that is.
Exactly. So that's coming. Yeah. When is that out?
Next July. So okay, I think July 7th, yeah.
What is that fallow period? Like, what do you wait for?
Right.
How do these things get started?
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, things start to flinch. I've weirdly discovered that I've started a couple of books while traveling.
Uh-huh.
Like, the beginning of Cabin at the End of the World started on a plane back from L.A.
Mm-hmm.
It was the weekend that my editor rejected the 30-page novel idea that I said. So I was just sitting on the airplane, doodling in my notebook, and I happened to draw a cabin. Now, I can't draw very well, so it was a rectangle with a V. But, you know, I looked at that, I was like, oh. You know, I instantly thought of the home invasion subgenre, which I typically don't like.
Yeah.
And there's some that I do like, but so I was actually weirdly inspired, like, oh, how would I do a type of story that in a subgenre that I typically don't like. Yeah, there, you know, I was excited by that challenge.
Yeah,
that's where Cabin started. And, this
novel, but the Cabin itself, like that doodle, just sort of popped out started, there because you're drawing squares,
right? Yeah,
you're not a good artist.
I was like, all right, who's in the cabin? Yeah. And I started with the family again, but I wanted to have like a family that was different than a handful of ghosts. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and disappearance of Devil's Rock. Mm-hmm. You know, then you're like, all right, why are these invaders coming? I wanted something that was different than, you know, the usual story. Right. I wanted to have a little bit of inversion of, you know, we've seen plenty of movies where like the people who are being invaded or the homeowners end up like attacking.
Right. That's sort of the trope of the genre. That's been happening,
yeah. You know, quite a bit. So, you know, some of it was just like trying to, like, how can I mess with those things?
And interesting.
You know, the original what if, like, oh, what if these invaders came because they're trying to prevent the end of the world? Like, why? And so, I mean, that's really how it started.
Yeah. And is it, again, like, you know, I'm sure these things all come in different ways, but is that frequently a way in is sort of the, you know, what tropes do I want to play with? What's the big idea?
Yeah, it has
you know,
been.
There's something
me,
something hooky, right? Something that's sticky to you.
It has been. I mean, certainly, I think for two of my novels, it's been like families, or for three of my novels, mm-hmm. families in crisis, and then this ambiguous supernatural element. And I suppose playing with like some sort of trope.
Yeah.
I don't know. I love, especially in horror. I mean, I feel like you should take advantage of the fact that I like to look at the horror genre as like this big century plus long conversation. All these stories are in conversations with each other. And I think that's the advantage of working in a genre. You get to, because you're going to have, you know, hopefully you get people who don't necessarily read horror, read your books. But for the ones that do, you know, they come into these stories with all this sort of like pre-knowledge of the genre. So why not use that either against them or use it in the story just to make it a new experience. So, I'm always looking for a little bits of inspiration or jumping off points to try to, you know, take something and, you know, if not make it my own, at least make it somewhat new.
Sure. What was it? Do you remember the kernel for Disappearance at Devil's Rock?
Yeah, so that one was more, I feel like it was the hardest thing for me to write in terms of like how much I beat myself up and how long it took to write.
Why is
that? So that one, I don't know. So that one didn't necessarily start with, it started with, I guess, three movies that I sort of mashed together.
Uh-huh. I love that.
And it was like a really sort of like a mystery structure. I don't know, I just found it hard to write. And I will admit that even though A Head Full of Ghosts hadn't come out yet when I was writing Disappearance of Devil's Rock, I was in my own head thinking, wow, A Head Full of Ghosts was so much easier to write.
Huh.
Which always happens in the afterglow, like you forget how hard it was to write the thing before. I was like, this isn't as good as A Head Full of Ghosts, and like...
But there is
that was really hard to get over that. Let me,
interesting.
So the best thing that happened, like in the midst of my self-pity and like having a hard time with this book, I emailed my friend and mentor, Stuart O'Nan, who's a wonderful writer.
That's great.
Super nice guy. And I was just like bitching on my email, like, hey, you know, this book's so hard to write. I don't think it's going to be as good as A Head Full of Ghosts. And, you know, I was looking for him to say, oh, you know, typically in your head, like, you know what, like, hey, you're a good writer, it'll be
right.
Fine, kind of thing. And all he wrote back was the one sentence I need to hear. He just wrote, not everything you write is going to be great. I literally started laughing.
It's
but
free.
Honestly, that was exactly what I needed to hear.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
And, you know, just totally free. You know, he's right. Like, you know, this is different. I'm just going to do the best I can. Kind of thing.
That's really funny. Let me stumble through.
That's honestly, other than like read all the time, that's like one of the best pieces of advice.
Absolutely.
As someone who's a working writer, to be reminded of that not everything you write is going
to
be great.
But it sounds like you don't tend to be precious during the process. I mean, it sounds like as you like, if you are going back over things day after day, work day after work day, you feel free to sort of throw away the stuff that doesn't work, and you're open to that process.
Oh yeah, sure, definitely.
But there is a big hurdle to taking on something new, and having that looming previous thing in your head.
Yeah, no, it is. And for me, like for novels, the 100-page mark is like a magical line for me. That's usually, you always, wherever I hit the 100-page mark, that's where, am I going to quit? Am I going to keep going?
I always have
that existential, like, this isn't very good. Always, like, it's weird. Always at that point, it's like, God, this is terrible. Maybe I should stop here. Because it feels like, okay, 100 pages, that's a lot, but that's not as bad as quitting after 200 pages
exactly.
or 150 pages.
Have you bailed at that point? And what are the things that you find either makes you bail or makes you stay?
So that's not true. I guess I've bailed a few times. And one, it became A Head Full of Ghosts afterwards. The reason why I bailed on this book that I was 100 pages into was I had the idea for A Head Full of Ghosts. So I was writing this novel. Its title was going to be Charles Manson Doesn't Answer My Letters, which is a great title. I should probably still reuse that.
Yeah, at least use it.
And I was excited about it. I told my agent about it. And this is after my two crime novels didn't do very well. So, I was spent a couple of years just like really struggling to write something. And, I told my agent about it. He liked it. But like after a year, I'd only written 100 pages. It was really, I'd sort of bogged down. It was slow going. And I was looking for excuses not to write. I was doing all this research. It was essentially just me reading about other stuff.
Yeah.
And
which
I was
is
reading,
easy to fall into.
Yeah. And I was reading a bunch of essays about the movie The Exorcist. And to me, The Exorcist was like this, boogeyman of movie, scariest movie ever. I'd seen it and it was scary.
Right.
But I'd never really thought of it in political context or even in sort of historical context. And these essays, like, really sort of, excited me. It's like, oh, wow, I never really thought the movie in those terms. And I was like, geez, no one's really written a possession novel in a while. How would you do that? And that's how, all of a sudden, a head full of ghosts just sort of spilled out. And so I quit. I quit on that other book.
Yeah.
Didn't tell my agent. And then later that summer, he asked, hey, how's that Manson book going? I'm like, well, I have 100 pages of this exorcism novel.
Funny.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's the case, right? It's
right.
Like this other thing. But this other thing sort of gets you excited and you can't wait to dive into it. But don't we have to also beware of this shiny new thing?
Yeah, no,
right?
Absolutely.
That can
be a
distraction.
It's a hard thing to call.
So how do you balance that?
And like,
you're also doing short stories,
yeah,
too, which I imagine
occasionally,
can sort of come in and out of.
I feel like luckily I'm not someone who's got like, a big pool of ideas just waiting for me to jump into. How's that for metaphor? typically, like especially if it's a novel, I'm pretty much almost like all zoned in. Other ideas really don't occur to me. If anything, I feel like I'm like nervous now because I'm not working on a new novel. I'm like, oh no, am I going to be able to come up with a new one?
Is it that every time?
I don't have it waiting in the wings.
Yeah.
So the shiny thing is that's a less danger for me. I know it is for other people who are just like swimming in ideas. Those happy, lucky people.
But I don't know. It's really funny. I don't hear that a lot. The writer who's like, I'm not sure what the next thing is. And I don't know, it must be freeing in a way that you can sort of let your mind ask the questions.
Right.
Right? You can, and then see what takes hold.
Yeah.
I think I've asked this a little bit already, but like, how do you start to circle those questions? Is it reading? Is it, being out just living life and things occur?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it's, ideas will come from reading. I mean, honestly, I get a lot of my best ideas in the shower, which is funny.
Absolutely.
Usually that's like when I fix things is in the shower.
Is that right?
Yeah. But sometimes, like in the case of Disappearance of Devil's Rock, I just sat my ass down with a notebook and was just trying to, brainstorm and come up with stuff. I've definitely done that too. But even last summer, I happened to be traveling though, so I kind of feel like that fits in the, I was on a train in England. And I do have this other novel idea, so I guess I'm somewhat lying that I don't have one, but I'm still not committing to doing it. I don't know if I'm ready for it. I thought I had one book left in my current deal, and I thought I was going to do this book, sort of a riff on Bolaño, 266, somewhat.
Yeah.
But this would be a hard novel to write, and it'll probably be really long and take me a while. So I sort of self-sabotaged that novel because I got to the summer, hadn't started it yet, hadn't outlined it yet. It's like, I only have a year left. I can't do this one. I'm going to have to come up with something else. So when I was on the train, I was just like, I thought of like other tropes, and I thought of like a zombie thing. I can't give away what the what the prompt was because it sort of gives away. But like I wrote this basic one sentence, what if? I was like, oh, huh. And it became this novel that still doesn't have a title yet. It might be called Survivor Song. That was its working title. We're still talking about what the title might be.
How do these deals work? They basically agree to put out a certain number of books in a certain amount of time.
The dates typically contracted, in the contract. I'm sure there's language in there. It's like, hey, if it's like 9 months off, then
right.
I don't know. But they haven't. It's really part of their schedule. So this most recent book deal was, for three books, which was Cabin at the End of the World, then Growing Things. Now this novel coming out next summer.
And what does that mean for an author to have this sort of security?
It's great. It's also it's a different form of writing when you're under like a contract as opposed to just writing without a contract. I do feel like it can be a little bit freeing to not have to write without a contract. Like, I wrote A Handful of Ghosts with the hope that it would sell, but there was no, like, deadline hanging over my head. I feel like there's, I don't know, there's something artistically appealing to that.
Totally.
You know, just that extra pressure taken off your back.
It suddenly becomes homework.
I think that was part of the reason why Devil's Rock was so hard to write, was because I had to have this thing. And I really wanted to make it. This is my second chance with a big publisher, and I knew I probably wouldn't get a third, so I didn't want to screw it up. And I had all that extra pressure sort of sitting on me.
Sure. I mean, do you feel, we talk about this in every industry, but like, it feels like the book industry is always in trouble.
Yeah.
Like, do you feel that as a writer, or do your editors and publishers and agents worry about that stuff? And like,
yeah, I tend not to worry about that stuff because I can't control it.
Right.
I'm like most any other writer. I'm usually complaining that X, Y, and Z, you know, could be done better.
Of course.
But no, my agent's the best. I've had him since 2006. Mm-hmm. So we're good friends. I know it's very rare to, you know, to have an agent that long. Mm-hmm. You know, my editor, Jennifer Brell, is amazing. I just love that, you know, she's no nonsense. You know, tell like it is, not in an asshole way, but in a good way.
Yeah,
you know, just someone who's honest with
forthright,
you.
Forthright,
yeah. She's not heavy-handed at all when it comes to edits. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that whole side of it, you know, I love those guys. It's just the business side of it I don't always understand.
Sure. That's why you have them.
Right. That's right. Or even just, like, I don't understand, like, why things get done the way they get done. But, I don't know. I don't work on that side of things, so I don't know.
Yeah. Let's talk about process a little bit. Do you enjoy the act of writing?
Not really. I mean, there are parts that I do enjoy, but most of it, it's work. It's hard to sit your butt down.
Yeah.
I mean,
what are the good parts?
For me, the fun parts are, you know, when you write something that you think is cool, like a cool scene, or like, you know, especially since I do sort of pre-plan out a lot of stuff, even if I don't write it down, it's in my head. If something unexpected happens, that's really cool.
Yeah.
And I will say, typically, once I have like the idea, I keep, there's always, without fail, a scene or two to me that are the carrots at the end of the stick.
Hmm.
Like, ooh, I have to write all this other stuff to get to that scene, because that scene's going to be fun to write. And those scenes usually are. Like, I'm excited to write those scenes.
And you write.
And I go in the order, I go in the order I think the book's going to be in. So I don't cheat and go, I'm going to write that scene first. You know, I have to get through all that other hard stuff.
You have to earn it.
Yeah. So, you know, some of it's just like little tricks to keep, you know, to make it new, make it different for me. So most of the time, it's, you know, I procrastinate and it's hard to get me to the chair.
Yeah,
I typically build momentum. Like for me, the slowest writing I do is always like the first half to 2/3 of the book, and then the last part it builds and I write a lot faster. And it's like, it's like, man, if I could write like this all the time, you know, this would be great,
right?
And I already feel like, because this summer I think I wrote more than I've ever written in terms of a chunk of a novel, and now it's like been a month that I haven't written. It's like, I've lost all that momentum.
Yeah, it's so hard to get back in. Do you feel like, I mean, and I think like this is the case for me, this is the case for a lot of people, that first third is so hard, and part of it is just the pattern of behavior, right?
Yeah.
Part of it is just sitting down and doing the work.
Right.
Another part of it is coming to understand your story and your characters and getting comfortable with them.
Right.
Even if you have done the outline, the pre-work.
Yeah.
What does that feel like for you, the getting to know the characters? Or the story?
Yeah, it's hard. I think a lot of, for the early part for me, a lot of it's pacing too, trying to figure out what the pace and tone is. Yeah, so this is the math part of me again, but typically I think, like, my goal is 500 words a day, but in the beginning it's probably closer to like 250 to 350.
Yeah,
you know, maybe
that's
a 400.
Not a lot.
That's not a lot. But, you know, again, it adds up.
Absolutely.
Every day.
If you can do that every day, it really adds up. And it's a reasonable goal.
Yeah.
When do you write? Where do you write? Like, again, you have a full time job, you have family. How do you find the time?
I used to do a lot more writing, like, anywhere, like if I had the spare time. Typically, you know, my kids are a little bit older. I do a lot of writing at night during the school week. But I've also, depending on the school year, if I knew I had like a couple of free periods, I would write to school. And I still can do that. But now I find I'm using that time for social media promotion, we'll call it.
I mean, there's all these other parts of the job, right?
Right. Now, as long as I have like headphones and I can block out what's going around me, I can write anywhere.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
That's
so good. I do have, I think just from the time management, I was forced to do this to be able to just zone in. Like, I don't have the luxury for writing rituals or like, okay, we're going to start writing now. This is what you have to do first. No,
you've had to train yourself to switch gears that fast, which, I don't know, that can be really hard.
I think part of it, what helps is I always start by going over what I wrote the day before. Mm-hmm. I mean, so that's sort of like, like first gear, getting into first gear.
You're not coming in cold.
Then you go for it.
Yeah, that makes sense. What do you listen to when you write? Do you listen to things when you write?
Yeah. Oh, I think my preference used to be silence, but I feel like I've inadvertently trained my brain now to have music on. It has to be almost exclusively instrumental. Yeah. You know, I have written to the Swan Sear album, mm-hmm. which has some lyrics, but it feels like an instrumental. Okay. But typically I'm listening to movie soundtracks.
Do you find that certain soundtracks have worked for it? Like, do you go back to the same soundtrack every time?
It's not just a random, like, it has to work. So for almost three full novels, I used 1999 movie called Ravenous.
Oh yeah,
starring Guy Pearce. Just like a cool eclectic soundtrack, and you know it has to be. I guess I kind of have to know it enough to be able to like just go into it. So you know it takes a few listens, you know, for me to be able to work with a soundtrack like that, so it can just fade into the background.
Right.
My favorite part about that soundtrack was like it was a perfect hour. So if I knew I had an hour. That's I can put that on and instantly. Just like, nope, I'm not even gonna look at my watch. You know, I know like this will be done in an hour, and I can go into it.
That's funny.
I've also used the Witch soundtrack quite a bit. Recently, I've been using the Black Coat's Daughter soundtrack.
It's a great one. Speaking of, you've got Oz Perkins working on Head Full of Ghosts still, as far as you know.
Yep.
This is the first adaptation of your work, right?
Yeah, Cabin's been optioned as well. Right. So both those, I can't say too much, but like, both are sort of like in, they both have come close to actually going and then get pulled back the last second. It's super frustrating.
Right.
It seems clear, very anecdotal, but it seems clear to me the only thing more screwed up than publishing is Hollywood.
Oh, it's a mess.
I say that with all the love in my heart.
Right. We love these movies, but we resent them.
I honestly don't know how anything gets made. How anything good gets made, especially talking to now. I have a lot of friends who work in that industry.
Well, listen, we got 500 podcasts.
People
trying to make stuff.
I know, it's a typical writer's lament. I was like, I just wish Hollywood people would let the writers and directors tell the stories.
Someone's got to pay for them.
Yeah.
Someone has to pay for
them.
How is it for you emotionally, mentally, to sort of hand over your babies like that?
I mean, it's very exciting. I know that objectively I'd be hypocritical by saying, oh, it has to be exactly this.
Sure.
Especially something like A Head Full of Ghosts, which is such a riff on all these different influences, mm-hmm. you know? So I would love to see what someone's take on that story is. You know, I will say, you know, this isn't just relegated to those two, so I'll keep it in general. But, you know, I've read screenplays of my things that I was like, meh, about. Mm-hmm. I've read one that I really liked. And I've read some that, like, I read one that I think I slept 2 hours that night because I was filled with so much anger and hatred.
Oh,
I could only sleep 2 hours.
What was it about that one that set you off?
There was just some, like, in a weird way, it was very, very faithful to the story, mm-hmm. but there were just some really, what I felt like, fundamentally awful changes to the goings on of the story that just, you know. Like, I don't understand why people would think that that was a good idea or a good thing.
I absolutely understand.
Yeah.
It's funny. I don't know. I've talked to writers who, when their stuff is adapted, really want to look at every draft and you know, take notes or whatever, as much or as little as those notes are listened to. My feeling is, like, I got to tell the story. Let's see what you do.
Yeah.
It sounds like you're falling somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, I think it depends.
Sure.
Maybe I shouldn't be. I mean, so there's one I've been having input in, which is great. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm very thankful. It's not contractual.
That's great.
You know, but I have been able to make comments on, like, the cabin stuff, which is very, very nice of them. With Head Full of Ghosts, I've had no say, mm-hmm. but which is also fine.
Right. Well, and you hope it's in good hands. And,
They
get the material.
I'm included. I'm, you know, so happy that Osgood.
Yeah.
You know, hopefully, if he gets to make it, I think I couldn't have. You know, I couldn't have, like, handpicked someone better for that for the story.
Absolutely.
So, you know, fingers crossed that he gets to make it. So we'll see. I don't know. Otherwise, I mentioned to you, I don't know if we started recording, but I mentioned to you I might try to to adapt a short story as a screenplay.
Let's talk about that.
I'm not so like I'm not so arrogant to think that I could. Oh yeah, screenplay writing is easy. It's clearly it's a different format. It's a different a different art form.
So this this is what I was going to ask. I mean, it is in many ways a different animal.
Right.
In many ways, it's the same.
Sure.
You know, it's still about structure, it's still about character, it's still about, you know, story. What are you doing to prepare yourself for this new format?
Well, I've read years ago, I read a bunch of books on screenplays, like or just even like old
forget
screenplays.
Forget everything you read.
Honestly, I'm trying to I'm trying to approach it a little bit like I approached writing. It was like I just I started writing like I never took classes. I didn't get an MFA. I was a math major. I just read a ton and started messing around.
Yeah.
So I kind of want to do the same thing with screenwriting. Like I watch a lot of movies. You know, I've read a bunch of screenplays.
Mm-hmm.
I will say, sort of as a, I will be a purposely obnoxious here, contrarian, say like the three act structure. It's like I want to rebel against that. Just like, no, how about if we just tell a good story?
Absolutely.
So I'm sure someone, if I write a screenplay, is going to be like, no, you need something on page 29 at the end of the
Nobody
first act or
says
something.
That.
Yeah.
Nobody. It seems to me that only new screenwriters tend to be that rigid about like format and structure and stuff. I think, you know, you're a storyteller. I think you've humbly internalized how movies and TV are made or how those stories are told. It should be pretty easy for you.
Right.
It's the formatting stuff that is like something to learn, and that's easy to learn. That's what you get from reading screenplays.
I mean, even like, I mean, I've taught like some fiction writing workshops, but I have a hard time with it a little bit just because, you know, I feel like I've internalized so much of it. Like, it's not to say the writing process is magic, because it's not.
No.
But at the same time, like, I fear just personally overanalyzing my own stuff for fear that I'm not going to be able to do it anymore, which sounds almost anti-intellectual, but it's not. Like, you know, I think clearly you can teach people to write, and I've helped people, and I've mentored people, and, you know, that part of it I think is cool. But at the same time, I don't know. I'm both, like, proud, and it's a hit to my self-esteem that I haven't gotten a degree in writing. Like, I think that drives me.
Really?
That, you know, I'm proud that I, you know, have had writing success without studying writing. But at the same time, like, I get, you know, especially around friends who, you know, were English, you know, professors. And, you know, they remember everything that they've ever read, like, in this amazing detail. And I can barely remember the character name, like, 3 weeks after I read it.
Sure. But isn't that kind of the great thing about writing is, like, it's such a democratic art. All you need is a pencil and paper. Everyone has a story. Everybody sort of intrinsically knows how to tell a story.
No, and I think it's both very cool and also frustrating that there is no, like, no one can say, hey, this is how you become a writer.
Right.
Or even, like, this is how you actually write. You can't tell anybody that.
Yeah.
I mean, you can obviously help train someone who is writing, and there are things you can suggest. And,
there's
but ultimately,
you can learn.
Yeah, there is. But ultimately, like, everyone sort of has to find what works for them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It sounds like, I don't know, you're still finding what works for you book to book, which is really interesting.
Yeah. No, I mean, I want to try to keep it, like, fresh. I mean, I feel like if it became so, like, we talk about how it's hard and it feels like work, I don't want it to feel like work all the time.
Yeah.
Because, I don't know, writing for me is a sacrifice. Like, I have a full-time job. Like, I know I try not to, but, you know, I've clearly taken some time away from, you know, my kids, and so it has to be worth it for me to do it.
That makes sense.
I'm not abandoning them. I want to make sure that's clear. You know, and I had them, you know, I took care of them all summer, every summer. There's daddy daycare in our house.
Sure.
But no, I mean, it gets important to me. Like, I could be, I still indulge in, like, when I finish something, like, I indulge in fantasies beyond, like, just more family time, but, like, oh, if I stop writing, I can go sit on the couch and watch everything, you know, that I haven't watched on Netflix or
Absolutely.
Other streaming services.
Yeah. Do you, though, feel compelled to continue?
Yeah, and then I always find my way over there eventually.
And that's what makes you a writer.
Yeah.
It's really funny. I don't know. Like, there's this other part of the job, which we don't get to talk about very often. Again, you have a family. We spend so much time in our heads as writers. How do you find yourself going in and out of that zone? And how much of a pain in the ass are you to your wife?
I think I'm not that, hopefully not that much of a pain. I kind of feel like I'm always in, sort of that headspace. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love teaching. Hopefully no one's listening to my high school.
But and I think, honestly, yeah. like just following you on social media, it's yeah. clear you love teaching, which is kind of like, as soon as I was making a living as a writer, I stopped yeah. teaching.
Right.
Because as much as I liked it, this was where I wanted to devote all of my
yeah.
energy. So no. you clearly love doing
it. I do. I mean, I would like to try writing full time at some point. Yeah, I mean, things have been great, but like, I don't know, we foolishly have a, I say foolishly in quotes, yeah, I have like this middle class lifestyle, house mortgage, and now sure. looking at 8 years of college tuition payments, I think it would be really kind of hard to quit the teaching part now. It's where we get our crappy health insurance.
Right.
For one. Yeah, I mean, I think if a movie were to actually happen to come out, I would probably try. But I am part. There's part of me that's a little nervous because that's a whole other added pressure that I've never had before. It's like writing to pay your bills.
Absolutely.
And I have, you know, I have friends who do that, and like I marvel and I admire that they're able to do that because I know that's a different kind of writing. I mean, I started writing when I started teaching, so they've both been so intertwined.
Yeah.
Like literally, like the day I started, or I don't know if it was the day, but yeah. the same time period I started teaching is when I started writing. So I don't know any other sort of calendar or schedule that's different. It's always
yeah.
been one. It's always been both.
Well, it's kind of great.
Yeah.
And it, yeah, and it means that one doesn't feel like a sacrifice to the other or vice versa.
Pretty oh, good. I sacrifice one for the other.
Being in the zone when you're writing, if you have that hour or you're doing your 500 or 1,000 words, it seems like it's easy to get into it for you. Is it easy to come out of also?
Yeah,
okay.
Definitely. Because if I come out of it, well, if I reach like 500 words, I typically feel very good. Like,
yeah.
You know, and that's actually one of the reasons why I think I keep going back, because there are sort of those addictive times where, ooh, that feels good to me. To have written something good or to make the word count, and especially when I'm done. Like, to me, that's sort of like the opiate high,
mm-hmm.
is I have this completed book, and I want everybody to read it. I mean, I'm definitely addicted to that.
Yeah.
Yeah, coming out of it is, that's easy for me. The getting into it is harder.
Yeah.
But so I have, like I mentioned, the trick of going through the previous stuff.
Yeah, that makes
sense.
Gear
up to it.
When you finish, what happens then? Do you put it aside? Do you get right into edits? What does that process look like?
Well, I mean, now it's like this book I just finished. I finished like 2 days before the deadline. Usually I'm like super early.
Yeah.
But I took a couple months off to write a novella for Amazon. Mm-hmm. So that cut into the novel time.
Yeah.
You know, typically I'm excited. Like if I'm done, I don't put it away. That's going to be built into the process now that I have an editor and a deal anyway. One of my favorite moments is to like print it out and to read it that way and to make edits that way.
Yeah.
You know, I do a lot of reading out loud too.
Really?
But I try not to, because not everything is meant to be read out loud,
yeah.
but there are parts that should be, you know, that are. So like I try to keep that in mind. But for me, the reading part of out loud helps me hear sort of the rhythm of the sentences. Because I do try to keep like a, you know, some sort of rhythm. Whether it's, you know, my own voice or the voice of the story. But, you know, now, like, when I get send the book to my editor, I typically don't see it again for another minimum 3-4 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So there's
that
built-in time,
off. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that
so then I get her.
You?
Oh, definitely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Come back. Are you able to come back with fresh eyes?
Yeah. I still have to, you know, once I get the edits, I have to go through the 24 hours of, like,
Sure. Sure. I mean, how do you feel about your work when you're done? There's something to that process of editing as you go that
yeah.
must make it feel like I'm pretty close.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm beating myself up throughout the whole process of writing the draft.
Yeah.
But typically, part of it's the glow of being done. I generally, when I have something finished, I feel good about it.
Yeah.
You know, I may still have like some lingering questions. You know, and again, it depends on the book. Actually, when I finished Devil's Rock, that was the one that was most like, yeah, I don't know. And I handed it to my editor. I was like, help. And that was the book that I've done the most changes post while we called
really?
The draft. Yeah, I ended up cutting like 10,000 words out and then putting like a new like 5 in and just new stuff around. And whereas like Head Full of Ghosts, we barely edited anything.
Mm-hmm.
All I did was like, there were ended up being three blog posts in the book, and when I wrote it, I had just one giant blog post in the middle and one at the end. She's like, why don't you have one for each section? I'm like, duh.
Right.
So I just cut the one in half and moved it up.
Oh, funny.
And I was lucky with Cab, and there was a lot of edits, you know, aside from like syntax and, you know,
sure.
just fixing
being dumb. Sort of almost cosmetic things. Do you feel like, it sounds like Head Full of Ghosts is the one that came out closest to what was in your brain.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Is that a different feeling either when writing or when finished writing than the subsequent books or even
the
previous
book? I feel like more than any other book, I felt really good in the writing of it, but still at that 100 page, I had an existential crisis, that 100 page moment. Yeah. Part of it was I had sent it to my agent, Stephen.
Right.
Where I was like, hey, I'm writing this other book. And when I sent it to him, you know, in his defense, he didn't know what it was going to become.
Sure. And it's different to what you
Yeah, it was just the first 100 pages. Yeah. He was like, oh, I don't know. Like, he had this other book in his head. He's like, I don't think this should be in first person. Like, his feedback really threw me for a loop to the point where, you know, I stopped writing for like 3 or 4 days. And that was really the only time I got bogged down in that book.
Hmm.
But ultimately, I said, you know what? I'm just going to write it the way I write it, and then we'll deal with it when it's done. And to his credit, when I sent him the finished book, you know, he wrote me an email and said, oh, I've never been so happy to say I was wrong. Like, this is amazing.
Oh, that's really
and that was, like,
feeling.
Actually one of the highlights of my professional career, because I was just dealing in a lot of self-doubt based on how the two detective novels had gone.
Absolutely.
That was a really cool moment. So, yeah, I felt good about that book. You know, I didn't know. I just felt like, hey, this is good. I have no idea if it's scary. Like, I'm a terrible judge, but scary. But I felt like it was a good book.
But you're telling the story that you set out to tell. Like,
and I was also just really excited to finally have written a horror novel. Like,
yeah.
My whole life I'd written tons of horror short stories, but everything that I tried writing at the novel length was more comedic. It was dark.
Yeah.
You know, obviously horror and comedy are kind of like,
absolutely,
almost like two slightly different reactions to the same absurdities or terrors,
mm-hmm,
right? Of life. You can either laugh at the absurdities or you can be terrified.
Sure.
So, I mean, there's a lot of reasons why I just felt like really excited by that book.
Yeah.
I'm very proud of Devil's Rock now. You know, it was like so hard to write. You know, I'm proud that I made it through. It's funny, the people, like, the book certainly hasn't sold as well as the other two, but the people who like that book, like, really like that
book.
That's great. It's very cool to hear, to have some people have that reaction.
That's really great. I mean, you're also now, you're in this horror community, and it does feel like there is a community.
Yeah.
What do you think your voice is in that?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know. I hope it's just a part of the increasing chorus of horror writers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think every writer who's ever lived wants to think, oh, I'm living in the golden age of whatever kind of writing. You know, so there's that sort of hubris to it. But I do think we're sort of in the middle of a renaissance or golden age of horror fiction.
I think so, yeah.
You know, just so many, you know, different types of horror stories being written, so many diverse, you know, adding diverse voices to horror.
Absolutely.
And hopefully that continues. I'm just happy to be, like, whatever part I'm playing, I'm happy to have a part.
Yeah, we're lucky you are.
Well,
let's wrap up, as I always do, by asking you what you're into these days. What great books have you read? What great movies have you seen, TV?
Okay.
Whatever's getting you excited or inspired.
So I'm rereading Mariana Enriquez's Things We Lost in the Fire, which I had read a year and a half ago. It's one of my favorite short story collections of the past 10 years. It's, she's Argentinian. Most of the stories take place in Argentina. And there's like some of the stories have this, you know, amazing socio-political subtext to them. But the range of stories, you know, is incredible. So, like, the first story is one of, like, the most disturbing things I've ever read. It's called The Dirty Kid. You know, a woman moves to, like, a really sort of sketchy part of this Argentinian city. Her family doesn't want her there, even though it's, like, the ancestral home. But it's less about what's going on inside her ancestral home. It's about what's going on outside of it. There's a homeless boy and her mom sleeping outside on a mattress, like right in front of her house. And it goes into like a weird, almost like satanic kind of thing from there. But she has like, you know, very subtle, almost like Jackson-esque stories with some of that like really sharp Jackson humor in it. She has a Lovecraftian story. It's just, it's an amazing collection. So I can't recommend that enough.
Great.
I just saw the movie One Cut of the Dead.
I just watched that
on Shudder, which, man, I heard people say they loved it. It was fun.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't know much about it. So I watched the first half for half an hour. I was like, oh, yeah, it's a cool schlocky, but it's one cut, you know, one shot.
Right.
Like, that's clever. And it was funny. But then, I won't spoil anything. I'll say the next hour, the last hour of the movie, I just had a big grin on my face. And even in the last 5 minutes, you know, the father-daughter thing, I had tears. Like,
amazing.
It was just such a joyous movie about creation, about what it's like to be a writer, a filmmaker, or even just someone who, like, anybody who creates, you know, if you're just doodling in your notebook, I think you can't not watch that movie and come away feeling, I don't know, inspired. So,
it's funny.
Yeah,
that's a good one. Yeah, that's on Shudder.
It's on Shudder. Yeah.
This is great. Paul, thank you so much for chatting. I can't wait for the new book.
Thank you.
And Growing Things is out now.
Growing Things is out now. Yes, please check it out.
Thanks.
All right, thanks, Ben.
Forever!